This is Radio Freethinker. This week, poverty myths, Wi-Fi poisoning, arm length, government, meteoric life, and talking animals. Now let's get started with episode 105.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be if we could talk to the animals, learn all their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea. I would converse in polar bear and python, and I would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people ask me, can you speak rhinoceros? I'd say, of carceros, can't you? If I conferred with our furry friends, man the animal, think of the...
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So, Ethan, how's been your week? Have you been talking about... No, we said before the show we won't talk about he who would be one in one and a half men or something, so...
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Excellent, excellent. Rock star to Mars.
Yes.
I thought we'd start off the show with one of my questionable questions to dive right into things. As I say, I'm trying to elicit some response from our audience. So hopefully they have opinions about something. And these are the questions that come to me that I sit there and I think are morally ambiguous, and I'm not quite sure how to deal with them.
So this week, keep you up at night?
Yes, actually, they keep me up. How do you know?
Oh, I know all. And see all.
Uh-oh. As everyone knows, I'm what I call a docking atheist, which essentially means that I think religion is a social negative, should fight it out wherever you can. But someone has asked me, well, what if someone came to me who claimed that a religion had allowed them to overcome addiction? Should I try and deconvert them, although this might lead them to become a re-addict or...
Relapse?
Well, relapse, that's the word I'm looking for. You know, as much as I think religion is horrible, and how I think that people who claim that religion has cured them of their addiction, they've just swapped one for another, there is a certain degree of social harm reduction there. And do I have a moral right to remove that one crutch for the other?
Mm-hmm.
Ethan, any thoughts? You think does this keep you up
at night? Well, I don't know if that would keep me up at night, but that does, I think, open up some interesting questions about, I think, individuality to a certain degree. You know, I think that some people fall into the trap of addiction because they don't have a social network or a close, perhaps family life to sort of help them through the bad points of their life. So maybe religion, not so much the dogma or even any of the harmful sort of ideology of religion does anything. It's more sort of the community, the idea of having like someone's got your back type stuff. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, if it's possible to substitute addiction for that, maybe it's possible to substitute the religious social, you know, backing with a secular one.
Well, you know, and that led me to the next sort of part of this. I'm going, well, okay, maybe, because I mean, I think I can kind of justify what you're thinking. I'm going, but maybe not. But would it matter then what they were addicted to? So if you had someone who was addicted to heroin versus someone who was addicted to cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, I think if someone was addicted to cigarettes, even if I thought they might, you know, relapse, and with cigarettes, I go, well, okay, I think the gain. But I mean, if they were a hardcore crack or heroin addict, would you think twice more about it? You know, I mean, that's
it's an interesting question, definitely.
Well, and then this is a few series that my head, they roll like this, right? Then, well, what about the different kind of religion? I mean, if they were a Catholic versus a Scientologist, would that make a difference? And then the idea about, well, would it make a difference if it was religion versus some form of spiritualism? So Catholic versus someone who said healing crystals stop their addiction. Or even, and we know how much we love this, homeopathy got them off of crack cocaine. Would you sit there and smash their belief in homeopathy if you thought it might lead them
to... I would be very curious to how homeopathy got them off crack cocaine.
Well, as you say, maybe it got them into a support structure or something.
Maybe,
I mean, again, it sounds arrogant, rational skeptics, and maybe we can see some of the mechanisms working behind where someone who's in the depth of addiction doesn't have that perspective. But yeah, so I mean, what do people out there think? Do you think that, you know, irrespective of the damage it might done, someone who claims that religion or spirituality has allowed them to conquer some form of addiction, should you try and drag them to rationality and critical thinking or not? Or, you know, is this just something, you know, as long as it doesn't interfere with the rest of their life, you can compartmentalize this issue. But that's just one of my questions. Speaking of questionable things.
I'm sure that most people are familiar with the Wi-Fi hysteria that has been gripping the media recently, and the issue has been particularly prevalent in Ontario. I know groups like CFI Ontario have been addressing it quite frequently in both print and media. However, I learned this week that it's not just limited to Ontario by any means. Recently, the question of banning Wi-Fi in schools came up in Maple Ridge, BC. So a local MLA, Michael Slather, is hosting a town hall-style meeting to discuss the issue. Now, this meeting includes a bunch of speakers, but their agenda is quite clear. They are against Wi-Fi. They want to remove it. And there was really no representation from the skeptical pro-science side. So some concerned parents, who are also good skeptics, contacted the people organizing this meeting and said, you know, I'm concerned about this fear-mongering here. So they said, well, okay, how about you guys come and represent the side of skepticism? Which is a good idea, because they actually have a website for skeptical parents, and I can give a shout-out to them at skepparents.org, and we'll post that in our show notes, so check it out. But they were kind of concerned that, well, we're not really experts either. You know, we're just concerned parents. So they contacted the folks at CFI Vancouver, who are helping them prepare with some CFI advisors who actually do have a background. And I think a number of people are actually going to drive out to Maple Ridge. It's a bit of a trek from Vancouver, but I think it's worth a good journey to help out and sort of lend a voice to the science aspect of this. I mean, I think most of our listeners probably know that the main issue with Wi-Fi really sort of comes up because of the sort of scary word of radiation. And unfortunately, you know, radiation is used to describe a lot of different types of radiation. You have some of it that's harmful and some of it that isn't. You know, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray can be harmful, whereas visible light and weaker radiation are not harmful. And people who don't have that science background just hear radiation and think, oh no.
Well, and a lot of people don't understand the fact that, I mean, everything radiates. I mean, right now, Ethan and I are giving off thermal radiation. I mean, it's a scientific term that has some specific instances that are bad, but it's a generalized enough term that it's used all the time. And that's why people can latch onto it and say, oh no. In fact, we did cover this quite extensively when it was up in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And we went into the scientific merits of it, of which there were none.
Yeah.
But I can attest too, in my alter ego, right? People come up to me saying, oh, I don't want Wi-Fi in my house because I'm afraid of the harmful ill effects. And I mean, I sit there and I'm stunned with them. You know, I sit there and I say, well, you know, how can you believe something that is so obviously false? By the mere fact that if it was poisonous, everyone in every school would have dropped over dead based on the kind of, you know, it's
disappointing. But, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who kind of promote this because it's a trendy thing to think about. You know, the Oprahs and the, you know, not skeptical talk radio shows of the world do a very good job of making this front center. Maybe on the show notes, I can post some links to some really good resources. One of CFI Canada's most important advisors, Lauren Trottier, who works with technology and Wi-Fi, has written a number of great articles, including in Skeptical Inquirer, the Globe and Mail, the National Post. There's lots of resources out there. So, I mean, don't hear a scientific term like radiation and freak out. Seriously, follow up on it. Look at what it actually is before you decide that it's dangerous. Because, I mean, if you're not an expert on it, it's very difficult to talk intelligently about it and also understand it.
Well, and that being said, too, I mean, just because you heard us say that it was safe doesn't mean you should just believe us any more than you should any other talking head. I mean, we have done a bit more research, but everyone makes that claim, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, this is where the idea of critical thinking comes into it. But, you know, in a way, I was talking disparagingly about people who come up to me, you know, when I'm working and mention this. But in one sense, I guess I can understand it, because we were talking last week about fluoridation and how people, you know, were, ooh, fluoridation's bad. But if you sit back, and we live in a society where there's so many things that are going wrong in our society, so many things that we have problems with, and not that our society is unique, things have always been going wrong, but there are a number of things that people just can't quite understand why things are falling apart, and they're desperate for some answer, for something that they can grab a hold of and say, I can change the world in this one little way, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't actually do anything, it's something they feel they have some control over. And I think that's one of the background psychological things that plays into this, that even if Wi-Fi isn't logically a source of something to be concerned about, it gives people something to blame for poverty. It gives something to blame for the fact that their kid is sick, or something to blame, and that they can actually do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of poverty, though.
That was a poor segue.
Oh.
Yes, recently an Angus Reid poll was released about Canadians' attitudes towards poverty. This was commissioned by the Salvation Army as part of their Project for Dignity, Dignity Project beginning, and it gives you an interesting outlook of what Canadians think about poverty and how that relates to the reality behind it. 49% of Canadians say poor people, if they really wanted to work, they could find a job. 43% of Canadians agree that a good work ethic is all you need to escape poverty, and 41% people believe that poor people would take advantage of social assistance no matter what. Now, this is in converse to the fact that there are actually a lot of poor people in Canada. One out of 11, or about, it works out to, I think, about 11.2% of Canadians live below the poverty line. That's 3.5 million.
And just for people who don't know, what is the poverty line?
Right. The poverty line is a statistics in Canada that, and actually every country has it,
yeah.
below which you can no longer maintain a healthy lifestyle. The poverty line in Canada, I had that number here, is roughly a little over 34,000 for a family of four in urban areas, and a little over 22,000 for rural areas, reflecting the fact that cost of living changes dramatically between the two. But of those people, so like I say, so some people say, well, they're just lazy, they just don't want to work, or it's a handout and people will just take the handout. Well, again, the logic of that falls through when you consider that like I say, over 10% of Canadians are below the poverty line, yet less than 7% actually take advantage of any form of welfare, right? Mm. So, you know, so if they were lazy people just taking advantage, you'd think there'd be more than those below the poverty line, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It also states that 23% of poor people are in that position because they're lazy. Sorry. It's sad. 28% say that poor people have lower moral values. Yet, according to today's statistics, at least as a percentage, there are more people in the workforce today than there have been at least since the 70s. And the stats that I looked at ended in the 70s. Now, granted, a large percentage of these account for women and students who have entered the workforce that didn't have to enter the workforce before. But if anything, that reinforces the idea that poverty is a very real thing when women and children have to work to help supplement the male of the family, at least for traditional families, mm-hmm. not to mention the fact that we do have a more liberal society. And that of those people who work part-time, those numbers have actually doubled. So even those people who are working, they're working a lot less because the economy has just diminished. The quality of work that people are getting are going, which reinforces the fact that, what was the one step, that if you have a good work ethic, you can escape poverty. Well, lots of people are working full-time jobs and still cannot afford to keep their family going. And, you know, the disconnect between the realities and people's opinions.
And the fact that there's a lot of people out there who are living below the poverty line and working like 12-hour days.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's really quite insulting when someone says, you know, oh, poor people are too lazy to get a job.
Well, you know, and that's the other thing, too, is that people just, they don't realize what poverty really is. Because when you have at least a semi-comfortable lifestyle, you disconnect. 37% of people agree that people who live in poverty still have it pretty good. Now, yes, if you're comparing that maybe to sub-Saharan Africa, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. But If you're a family of four and you live in a two-bedroom or even a one-bedroom apartment, that's a pretty small, cramped quality of life. And then what kind of food do you get to buy under that kind of thing, right? Apparently, 54% of Canadians believe a family of four can survive well on less than $30,000 a year. And as I say, Stats Canada says that that number is actually $35,000, a little over $34,000. And that 21% think that $20,000 is enough. And I'm just, again, if you've gone out and you've tried to rent an apartment, even in the suburb areas, what was it? I did a little calculation of my own that if you your room and board, sorry, just your rental fees will be anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 a year just to pay rent for a family of four, and that's like I say, either two
in,
or three
in
bedroom
area or.
No, that includes things like New Westminster and all that, right? Yeah. Now, granted, if you move to Abbotsford, but here's the catch 22. If you move out to the boonies, there are less jobs in the boonies,
yeah,
right? So,
or you could
no offense to those people who live in Abbotsford. I use the boonies as a colloquial term.
Sure, but I mean, even you could say, well, the same thing is true because if you move to like a part of the country that has lower rental rates, they also have a slower economy.
Exactly.
Places like Hamilton, where they've been really hit bad by the economic downturn, there's less jobs available. So I mean, you're not really swapping a better situation by moving to places with lower.
Well, and that's why, again, you know, the poverty line lowers when you're in a rural area versus an urban area.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that lowering is, again, there is less money to be had in those areas. So just to sort of round out my statistics, the average family of four with two working parents have an annual income of, guess, what do you think the annual average income?
I would probably guess 40,000.
Family of four with two parents.
That's
no, okay, no, 80,000.
80? Okay.
Yeah, which is 40,000 each.
Okay.
Which is a lot more than I'm making right now.
That's more than I'm making.
And you know, the funny thing is too is that, I mean, even though Canadians seem to have a very negative attitude towards those people who are poor or who are taking social assistance, in an odd sort of way, they're very positive. They're very exemplified the Canadian attitude. 89% of Canadians agreed that people in poverty deserve a helping hand, even though, what was it, 41% think that they would get it even if they don't deserve it. 81% think that helping poor families helps set up children for success, which is something that's been proven time and time again in most cultures in society. 96% agree that everyone deserves a sense of dignity, although at the same time, 65% of them thinks that just being poor robs you of your dignity.
Sounds like a very schizophrenic poll.
It is, you know, in many ways. But, you know, how that schizophrenia helps leads up to the part is that 24% say they don't really see many poor people in Canada. They don't really see the truly poor. And in some ways, you can see how that happens. Because, I mean, poor people do tend to get marginalized. They either become invisible because you learn not to see them.
Right.
Or they're in the back alley scrounging for food, so you don't. They're not in your face. And that odd sort of way makes you think they don't exist, although they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the other part, last one I have here, is that 18% say poverty is a problem that you can't really do much about. Which I think is the part that crushes everything, because once you sort of give up that there is an answer to it, then you accept the fact that poor people are going to suffer and nothing I can do. Let's see what I can get for me, which is a very un-Canadian attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the take-home message from this, and I suggest this to anyone who goes to any number of the grocery stores, if you look and you'll see there's a little slip there, usually for BC Food Bank, where you can donate $2 for a meal. Grab them, $2, not much out of your thing, but that's a meal for someone. There's a lot of poverty in this country. Help out. Helping the poor helps everyone, because once you start raising yourself out of poverty, there's a snowball effect that helps them raise themselves even higher.
Mm-hmm.
That and let's not shop at Walmart. Oh, sorry.
Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So, another sort of major news item, and that's been making the rounds, is life potentially being found in a meteorite.
Again? Didn't they have the same story about a decade ago? Meteorite from Mars. Oh, it was Mars. That's right. So it was a meteorite, but it was in Mars. Yeah.
Well, as I said, major news outlets around the world were reporting that life had been discovered in a meteorite. But what you actually have here is a textbook fail by major media to fact check and demonstrate the most basic level of skepticism. So the first red flag that I think should be noted is that this story was broken by a news agency that is known for shady science journalism.
Russia Today. No. Glenn Beck.
Maybe his network. But the other red flag is that it was based on an article published in a very dubious science journal. And if you check around, some of the skeptical blogs like P.Z. Myers and Phil Plait have actually discussed this journal in the past. And it's full of some very strange and somewhat nefarious sounding marketing plans to get you to buy books. Nevertheless, the story is that a NASA scientist, Richard Hoover, claims that he found structures inside a rare type of meteorite, the Orgulie meteorite, which fell in France in 1864, and that these strange structures look very much like microbes of some sort. Now, our good friend P.Z. Myers at Feringula called this, the hunt for microbes on meteorites, an example of pareidolia. Basically, this article has a bunch of pictures of supposed meteorites and a bunch of little arrows pointing at squiggly lines going, oh, that's a microbe and that's a microbe. I mean, well, frankly, you know, looking for a face on Mars will probably get you more results.
Well, isn't it? I mean, it's even one step removed because it's not the microbe. It's the fossilization of the microbe.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So according to the most experts with this sort of thing, rocks have microfractures, and microorganisms are very, very good at getting into these incredibly small microfractures. And in the vast history of scholarly research, everything seems to indicate that earthbound microorganisms are extremely fast at invading rocks, even rocks from space. So showing microbes on a meteorite and that it's trying to prove that it's not a contaminant is an extremely difficult thing to do. And first, you need to demonstrate that what you found has different chemistry or a different coding information or something else, because just saying, look, microbes on a space rock does not mean it's life from space. You have to make it very clear that what you're looking at is significantly different from something you would find here on Earth. And with the actual paper itself, you have these pictures of rocks with squiggly lines, and underneath you have the words, see? Well, not quite that, but it's just as bad. I mean, it's just like pictures of rocks and little arrows going, squiggly line.
Well, no, to be fair, I've looked at these pictures, and they look impressive as, ooh, that's a nice little structure. But you're right, you wouldn't have. In fact, it was so bad that on Fox News' website, they had a picture that was supposed to be, life from satellites. But what the picture was actually a microbe on Earth that these squiggly lines were supposed to look like.
Yeah.
So they didn't even actually have the original. They actually showed a genuine bacterium. But that's just like, oh yeah, you see this and see the structure here, it kind of looks like, but that wasn't even on the news articles that this press was spreading around.
Exactly. They basically had pictures of real microbes kind of in the article and not really clearly labeled either, so that you kind of thought that these microbes were what appeared in the meteorite. So all around, a big fail for the major news outlets. Fortunately, the blogosphere has once again picked up the slack.
But what will be sufficient evidence for us to say that there is life in these meteorites? Because almost by definition, you're saying that it can never possibly be one. Because once they land on Earth, you could always say that they were contaminated by life on another planet.
Well, I mean, what you would definitely need is... You need a very good smoking gun. Like, I mean, unfortunately, I think just by the nature of this type of claim, it's going to be a difficult sell regardless. I mean, you're going to have to find something that clearly shows, like I said, you know, an alien form of chemistry, completely different DNA structure, something that just shows this can't be from Earth.
Right. So we're not saying that there isn't life out in the space, that there isn't even life on meteorite. There could have genuinely been life on a meteorite that crashed in the planet.
Absolutely.
All we're saying is that the evidence that was presented here is at best dubious and at times definitely...
kind of suspect.
Suspect.
Yeah.
But you should buy the guy's book. No, you shouldn't. Sorry. Yeah, actually, I went to that website and I thought it was a joke originally, but...
yeah.
But speaking of dubious or interesting or suspect...
I see, yes.
I was following one of the stories that we were talking about earlier about usage-based billing and the internet. Usage-based billing is something the CRTC ruled was legal to do, which essentially eliminated a whole class of billing of unlimited internet access for people and for secondary service providers. This was countermanded by the government. And I went, well, okay, this is kind of, you know, I'm in the internet and, you know, this is sort of an interesting thing. But then it led me into sort of a pattern. And I wanted to, again, ask another interesting question maybe. Our government sets up a number of things what are called arm-length institutions, right? So the government has the ultimate say in everything, but we set up a number of arm-length groups that are supposed to perform certain functions or do certain investigations or rule on certain things that are supposed to be independent of politics, ergo independent of the government at hand. Because in, what was it, in 2007, the Canadian Nuclear Commission had ordered the shutdown of Chalk River because it wasn't meeting safety standards. There was a bit of an uproar, somewhat of a false uproar, about there not being enough nuclear isotopes for medical test research. And the Canadian government stepped in and overruled the commissioner, and to the point where she actually lost her job.
Mm-hmm.
In 2009, the CRTC rejected an application of Global Live to provide cell phone coverage. But again, the industry minister had stepped in, countermanded or told the CRTC, no, you need to rethink this. And Wind Mobile, which is people knows all around, was started by this company. And although, of course, that decision itself now has been, I think, thrown out by the Supreme Court because it broke the law. So even if you want to. Earlier this year, this, as I mentioned, the CRTC approved usage-based billing only to have the government come in, granted, reacting to popular demand, to tell the CRTC, no, you need to rethink this. Last week, and this we're getting a little sideways, but still, last week a decision by the federal government to change how the government media releases are to be worded changed it from the government of Canada to Harper's government, which is sort of a... and last week, the Citizenship and Immigration Minister released a campaign document targeting minority communities on official government letterhead. Now, those last two are sort of going the other way, where politics is going into government. The other one's government being interfered into politics, I guess. But the question, the thing that's raised here is that we want to have representative government, but we know every so often that it tends to get trampled by the politics of the time. Now, these ones here, we all sit there and say, oh, that's great, we like that. But there's been a number of times when things like climate change, right, things that are at the heart of skepticism, or ideas about abortion, stem cell research, where we kind of want these arm's-length government institutions to make their decisions based on the science, the evidence at hand, and even if the mass population don't really agree with it, you shouldn't fiddle with what these arms-length groups have done. Mm-hmm. There are other mechanisms to override them if you need to. I mean, you can change the law, right? I mean, like, say the CRTC thing, CRTC is just interpreting law. If you don't like the law, you change the law. And just at what point do we feel comfortable with having the government interfere with these arm-length institutions? CBC is another great one. And at what point do we allow politics to interfere in our government in general? Like, mm-hmm. I say, with the fact that we no longer have the government of Canada doing things, we have Harper's government, you know, as an official motto. I mean, everyone says Harper's government, but... So what do you think, Ethan?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think part of the problem is, though, that a lot of times these sort of arm length organizations are handpicked by the very politicians who will later ignore what they say. So it's kind of difficult in many regards. I don't think I have a problem too much when it's, in many sense, an independent organization staffed by experts. You know, I recall a lot of the investigation when a lot of the vaccine problems arose in the United States. They had a lot of independent medical organizations review the data, make recommendations, and the government would just sort of ignore it. That's more frustrating. I think on some level, though, you need to have an independent, not so much a sort of a, you know, kind of backroom deal type thing where you have the government picking their experts in quotation marks, right, to make a ruling. It's a difficult question to answer.
Well, I mean, and we were talking about this last week too, again, with the fluoridation issue, right, where the City Council of Calgary had one motion before is to make the decision whether to continue fluoridating the water, given to a panel of experts who would weigh the evidence, mm-hmm, and come up with a decision. And instead, they took a political decision in spite of the evidence.
Right. Well, let's take a break at that, and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
Yes!
Hi, I'm Penny Clark, president of the CITR Student Executive. Between March 7th and 11th, the UBC's Alma Mater Society will be holding a referendum. By voting yes, you will be supporting the continuation of the UPass and a new fee structure to improve AMS student services. This new fee structure includes a $1 increase for CITR and will protect our current funding in the future. With the additional dollar, we will launch a DJ training program, beat matching and spinning, and offer free DJs for your student events. CITR is committed to serving students and staying tuned to student needs. Between March 7th and 11th, vote yes in the AMS referendum.
Yeah! Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. But I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
So that was Tiggy.
I'm sorry, my voice was off there. I was trying to say hello, but I couldn't. No, sorry. Who was it?
That is Tiggy, the talking cat, supposedly saying hello, although to me it sounded more like meows to me.
It's meow, howl.
With the pareidolia coming into it, I'm sure.
Anyway, so we're going to be talking now on Radio Freethinker, can animals talk?
Crazy. Oh, wait a minute. Ethan, we know this. We know the answer to this question already.
Oh, do we?
Well, I mean, you are a plant, aren't you?
Well, some people don't realize this, but I'm actually a talking photograph.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And I am a space meteor, right? Yes, yeah. I hadn't thought that one through. But,
yeah.
But no, so we're not talking about animals as in humans.
No, for the moment, we're going to discount humans simply because it makes this conversation a whole lot easier. What we're going to talk about is, can animals communicate with humans and humans with animals? And I think before we go too far with this, we want to clarify what we mean by talking. Well, let's say that we don't mean. We don't mean basic communication. It's pretty obvious that animals can communicate. We can communicate with themselves. We can communicate with us. That's a pretty basic given. We know that animals can communicate within certain limits. What we're kind of talking about here is whether or not animals can talk to humans and we can understand them. We can talk to them, they can understand us.
So do you mean, so when you said communicate, you mean animals may, in their own way, have their own language.
Sure. They may,
and they may
meow.
Right. And the meows may mean something abstract to them.
Mm-hmm.
But can a cat learn English or an equivalency of it?
Yeah, yeah. That's sort of what we're talking about here. So people might say, well, who would even suggest that? Well, actually, it has been suggested, and it's not really widely accepted, and we're going to try to figure out what's really happening with these cases. So one example of an animal talking, and this is actually a good sort of intro to this conversation, is Alex the African gray parrot, who was a project of animal cognition expert Irene Pepperberg, and she claimed that Alex could indeed understand the words that he was saying and even learn new words. Well, her research with Alex is indeed quite fascinating. There are several reasons why I'm skeptical of it. First, it was performed with one animal working closely with a researcher, which makes the situation very susceptible to the Clever Hans effect, which is actually a very interesting segue, because the Clever Hans effect was named after another animal that was thought to be communicating with the outside world. The animal in question was a horse named Hans, who was owned by Wilhelm von Austin, and it was believed this animal could communicate and do arithmetic. The horse was supposed to have been able to add, subtract, multiply, divide, work with fractions, tell time, keep track on a calendar, differentiate musical tones, read, spell, and understand German. I mean, this horse is pretty smart.
Wow, I can't even understand German.
No, I can't either. And the way he would do this is by tapping his hoof. So questions could be asked verbally, or they could be written down, and the horse would tap his foot to indicate his answers, I suppose. So after some investigation, it was discovered that Hans didn't learn math at all. Rather, he was responding to the questioner. And they tested his claims by isolating the horse and questioner from spectators, so no cues could be come from the spectators. They used questioners other than the horse's actual owner. They used blinders, so sometimes the horse couldn't see the questioner. And they varied whether the questioner knew the answer to the question he was asking. And after a number of trials, they found that the horse could get the correct answer even if von Austin wasn't asking the questions, which kind of ruled out the possibility of fraud. However, the horse could only get the right answer when the questioner knew what the answer was, and the horse could see the questioner. So what they discovered was that the horse was picking up on facial expressions, and expressions or tension or the way the person was standing when they asked the question. Apparently what it was that as the horse was tapping his hoof, it could tell if the person got anxious. And when the person got anxious, the horse would stop, which seemed to correlate when the person thought the horse was getting close to the right answer. So that became known as sort of the Clever Hans effect.
So now we're just clarifying here. We're not saying that animals cannot communicate, because obviously this horse was communicating with the trainer and the trainer was communicating with the horse.
Right.
We're talking about here, did the horse understand the English, German, I guess it was in this case, words that were being said, as opposed to was it able to understand the other cues that the body was giving off, right?
Exactly.
So we're talking about a very specific kind of talking here, not strictly speaking, communication in general.
Right. And we should also point out that we're not talking about mimicking either. And that's sort of why I mentioned the parrot, because parrots are very good at mimicking sounds, and people often train their parrots to say hello and, you know, I love you and that kind of stuff. But again, we wouldn't say that the parrot is communicating with it. It doesn't understand what it's saying. It's not like it's putting towards sentences in his head and telling you them.
Are you saying my parrot doesn't love me?
Well, it might like you in the sense that you provide its food.
No.
But it probably doesn't have strong feelings for you.
Hmm.
Yeah. Sorry.
The wedding's off then.
I guess so. So some other examples of maybe not talking animals, but animals that are trying to communicate. And one of that is the signing primate. So monkeys, chimpanzees that have learned American Sign Language. Now, one of the earliest cases was a primate, a chimpanzee named Washu, and this was sort of in 1969 to 1970s. And the case involved Alan and Beatrice Gardner of the University of Nevada, who reported that they had conversed with a member of another species, Washu, a female chimpanzee. They claimed it learned approximately 350 words of American Sign Language. So, in 1967, Alan and Beatrix Gardner established a project to teach Washu ASL at the University of Nevada. Previous attempts to teach chimpanzees to imitate vocal languages had all failed, and the Gardners believed that these projects were flawed because the chimps are physically unable to reproduce the voice sounds for spoken language. So the solution was to utilize the chimpanzee's ability to create diverse body gestures and teach it American Sign Language. So they started this project, and they raised Washu as one would raise a child. She frequently wore clothes, sat with him at the dinner table. She had her own 8x24-foot trailer, complete with a living and cooking area. The trailer had a couch, drawers, refrigerator, a bed with sheets and blankets. She had access to clothing, combs, toys, books, and a toothbrush. And she was raised like a human child, and she went underwent regular routine with chores and outdoor play and went for car rides. And the idea was they wanted to resemble the raising of a human child. The Gardners thought this would facilitate her ability to learn the language. In fact, when Washu was around the Gardners, they were very careful to only communicate in ASL. They didn't use verbal communication. And they assumed this would create a less confusing environment, and this is actually how they teach children to learn ASL as well. They don't talk around the child. So after the first couple of years, the Gardners discovered that Washu could pick up ASL gestures without operant conditioning, and that's very important. Operant conditioning is the use of is a behavior system where you use rewards, positive-negative reinforcement, positive-negative punishment to enforce or, I guess, punish certain behavior. And they were saying that they were not using this method. So one example is that they would sign toothbrush to each other while they brushed their teeth near Washu. And at the time, Washu showed no signs of having learned the sign, but on a later occasion, she reacted to the sight of a toothbrush by spontaneously producing the correct sign, thereby showing that she had learned what a toothbrush was and how to express it with language. Now, the Gardners believed that rewarding particular signs with food or other positive rewards was actually going to cause problems for the teaching of the language. So they didn't. They never juxtaposed food and meal times with instruction times. So they were trying to control for this notion that they're rewarding the monkey for various things. And for the researchers who were keeping track of all this, in order for them to consider that Washu had successfully learned a sign, she had to use it spontaneously and appropriately for 14 consecutive days. Then the signs were further tested using the double-blind vocabulary test. And the test demonstrated that the subject could communicate information under conditions in which the only source of information available to a human observer was the signing of a chimpanzee. The other sort of benchmark was that the chimpanzee used the signs to refer to natural language categories, so that the sign for dog could refer to any dog, flower to any flower, shoe to any shoe. And the hope was that she was learning this in the sense that she was actually recognizing why a sign meant a certain thing. And as Washu gained popularity, she inspired a lot of imitators and a lot of other research. In fact, in the early 1970s, she appeared on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Ooh.
Yeah, it must have been fun for her.
Who's Johnny Carson?
Johnny Carson was the former host of The Tonight Show. You know that, dude.
Oh, you mean the one that Jay Leno took over from?
Yes. Yeah, sure. So another famous example of a signing primate is Coco the gorilla. Everybody knows Coco, right? She was trained by Francine Patterson. At the time, she was a graduate student at Stanford University. And according to Patterson, Coco was able to understand more than 1,000 signs based on American Sign Language and understood approximately 2,000 words of spoken English. And it should be noted, however, that the degree to which Coco mastered these signs has been very controversial and hotly debated. Patterson, as well as some other scholars such as Dr. Hashabala of the Harvard Institute, believed that Coco did know her signs and had mastered sign language to that extent. Now, other researchers argue that she did not understand the meaning behind what she was saying and that she was learning these signs because she was being rewarded for doing so, in fact, indicating that her actions were a product of operant conditioning. Now, as with most cases of these sort of things, the trainers would be quite adamant that no operant conditioning was going on, but it remained to be seen whether or not that actually is true. Another concern that was raised about Coco's ability to express coherent thought through the use of signs is that the interpretation of the gorilla's conversation is left to the handler, who may see artifacts that they consider meaningful when other researchers say, well, that doesn't really mean anything. It's sort of like pareidolia.
Right.
Only not quite that extreme. There's another signing primate that I think is an interesting story. And this one was trained by Herbert Terence of Columbia University, whose chimpanzee was named Nim Chimpsky.
After famous linguistic and political activist Noam Chomsky, who got a Nobel Prize for the idea of universal grammar.
That's right. Terence set out to prove that chimps could communicate using ASL, and he wanted to prove it with Nim, who that's the name of the chimp. So at the beginning, his progress matched Washoe's quite closely. By September of 1977, Nim had acquired about 125 signs, not too dissimilar from Washoe's rate of vocabulary acquisition. He started stringing together signs into little sentences, and Terence and his colleagues collected over 20,000 instances where Nim put words together in potentially grammatical sentences. For example, if Nim wanted more of something, he would likely sign more something, whereas something was whatever it is he wanted. He was less likely to sign it backwards, so he wouldn't say, you know, banana more. He would say more banana.
Okay.
Similarly, Nim was able to put a verb and a noun together quite frequently, and he was lucky to put things together like eat grape rather than grape eat. Patterns like this had convinced both the gardeners with Washoe, but Terence as well, that Nim was learning. But then I think Terence started to see some flaws with this line of thinking, and he got a little bit skeptical. Skepticism started to creep into the whole thing, and basically it was because of the syntax and grammar. He wasn't convinced that despite the fact that the chimps were using sign language, they weren't understanding what goes along with it. The other problem that I think rose from this is that American Sign Language does not perfectly translate into English as well. There is its own sort of syntax problems as well. So, continuing with the research, Terence and his team collected videotapes of Nim with his trainers and proceedings and analyzed them frame by frame, trying to figure out if Nim understood what he was doing, if he could understand the meaning and the context behind his signing. And then Terence released his results in November of 1979. Now, his paper was summarized in the New York Times as Herbert S. Terence now asserts that the success of his own and related efforts to can be explained as mere prompting on the part of the experimenters and mistakes in reporting the data. Much of the ape's behavior is pure drill, he said. Language still extends as an important definition of the human species. So basically, he reversed his position. He set out to prove something, realize halfway through, I'm wrong, and it's not working.
Which we have to give kudos to him, because a true scientist follows the evidence, not follows the theory.
When I first heard about this, I thought, oh, he's setting out to prove something. But I think he sort of caught up to him and he realized. The thing is, though, like many other scientists, once he released this research, it sort of started a bit of a controversy. A lot of other researchers thought that he was not being fair to the research. And it kind of started a bit of a argument in the field.
Well, Ethan, I have some questions for you.
Sure.
That I was thinking there. So going on with the general topic, I mean, you brought up a few instances of where people thought animals could talk, and it turns out they couldn't. But we know animals can learn, right? I mean, we can teach animals very complex tricks, and we've seen animals use tools in nature without human prompting, so we know they can learn something, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we also know, to a certain degree, at least in a few instances, that actual animals can learn abstract concepts. There is a species of monkey in the African who have, and I'm going to use this term very loosely, words for things like snake, lion, hawk, because they've done certain, and they're reasonably confident that, at least to these monkeys, that when they hear a particular call, it has a particular abstract meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can learn, and they can learn a series of commands, doesn't that somehow equivalent to a ground? I mean, at what point are we saying that they can't learn human language? And is it the type of thing that if animals can't learn human language because of some biological block, mm-hmm. does that mean humans can never actually ever learn animal languages? Because I can't see why we would be somehow special with regards to that.
I mean, it's an interesting question. I think that it might be possible. I mean, I think it's going to be easier for us to communicate with animals. It's always going to be easier for us to communicate because we can, if we can't make a dolphin sound, but we can make a machine that can. The thing that stood out to me for the research with the primates is that they kind of thought that these primates would develop sort of like a child and then sort of maybe hit a brick wall at a certain point. But what they realized was that sort of like Nim and the others, they failed to initialize conversation. They seldom introduced new vocabulary, and they generally just imitated what humans did around them, which is, you know, a child will do that too, but the child quickly grows out of that and starts to add to their growing pool of knowledge, whereas the chimps seem not be able to get past that stage.
Maybe that's one of the limitations of how we look at them. Because, I mean, as much as we claim to be, you know, evolutionary Darwinists and we don't want to see things through the Christian eyes or anything like that, but we somehow think of apes and chimpanzees as just less developed humans, whereas they're not. They're fully developed chimpanzees, and they are a very separate animal from us. And although we may share a historical heritage, they are not underdeveloped humans. They are just... they're separate things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're not dealing with, proto-humans
right.
in any sense of the imagination. I mean, these are distant relatives. But I think there is definitely, I think, worth in trying to analyze how their cognitive abilities are progressing, because it can be perhaps useful when we try to figure out how language developed for our, you know, human ancestors.
True, but maybe another thing that's playing into this too, and again, remember, I'm the philosopher, that in my research into artificial intelligence, you often get this claim that, oh yes, it knows the word, but it doesn't understand it.
Yeah.
Where you sit there and say, well, what do you mean it doesn't understand it? It knows, it sees a banana, it says, hey, that's a banana, it says, I'd like to eat the banana, bananas are good, and you go, well, how is that really any different than me understanding the word banana, outside of the fact that as me, I have an internal access to say, oh, I know it, and I make the assumption that you have an internal access that you know it. But I mean, I don't know you understand the word banana any more than I do the chimp
right.
understands the word banana, outside of being very anthropocentric. I think that's the word, human centered.
Okay. Yeah, and that does sort of come up in the research as well, from what I read. There were a lot of, I think, perhaps hand-wringing and maybe some wishful thinking going on because, again, some of the difficulties in translating American Sign Language to English, for example, they had a lot of problems figuring out if the chimps understood the concept of ownership, because I think the words for things like, for example, me banana is the same as my banana. So are they saying, that's my banana, or are they saying, give me the banana?
Well, we talked about the last show, too, about the concept of numbers, the innate idea of numbers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the idea of ownership is just not something that is comprehensible to another species besides Patak, humans and maybe
well, I think lions. They probably understand, like, maybe not ownership, but control. Like, I mean, you look at, like, documentaries of chimps. They do seem to fight over resources. So they must understand some concept that this will make me survive better.
True, but that's a wholly different thing to say in it's mine versus want or need.
Sure.
Right? Yeah,
that's part of the problem, though, that is trying to understand to what extent they understand those concepts, if at all.
Which, of course, leads to the ultimate thing, I think, with your thing, is that it's not so much that animals cannot talk, because we haven't had any evidence convincingly that they can, although some research hints at it, maybe.
Yeah.
But we don't really even quite understand what the question is yet, because, I mean, one, are animals capable of talking amongst themselves? And we're still not even sure that's possible.
Yeah.
We're not sure we understand what it means when we use the term talk in some ways. Again, like I say, if you're linguistic and you go into the idea of language, you understand that even how we understand what we are saying is very variable, not very secure. I mean, we use language, but do we really understand how language functions in the human brain? And there's a lot of research to be done into this.
Absolutely. And, I mean, unfortunately, we're kind of running out of time. I had more to talk about, too, including a talking mongoose.
I like the one with the elephant.
Yeah, the elephant was good, too. But the mongoose, man, I love that mongoose. Anyway, we're pretty much running out of time. We should go on to our skeptical highlights, I think.
Almost. I just want one thing I thought was funny.
All right.
The SGU was talking about a one-eyed mole that was picking the top Academy Award winners for last
one. Oh, yeah.
And Jay Novell, I think it was Jay, although it could have been Steve, could have been one of them, had sat there and said, well, anybody could have guessed that the King's speech was going to be the number one pick for the nominee. And I'm going, wait a minute. Any human would have known that. But we're talking about a cross-eyed badger or something, right? I mean, I doubt it's seen the movie, and if it did, it probably didn't understand the significance of the movie and the movie portrayal that was in there. And I'm going, how can you say that? Oh, well, anyone could have guessed that. Sorry, it laughed hysterically about it.
Well, you know who might have gotten that was Winston Churchill's parrot, who apparently he trained to talk and had a very firm grip of the times that he lived in.
Grisp?
What's that?
Grisp?
Crisp.
Oh, crisp.
Yeah.
Okay. So, skeptic highlights.
That's right.
I have two this week. Another Philosopher's Cafe, and they're going to be talking about memory. Moderator Michael Picard, no relation to Jean-Luc Picard yet, although
he's a fictional character, I would say so.
But he's a fictional character several hundred years in the future, so there could be a Jean-Luc Picard in there somewhere.
Okay.
Explores the wonders and worries about memory. So that's this March 10th, 12 p.m., tickets $5 at SFU Harbor Center. And Amnesty International UBC is presenting When is a Democracy Not a Democracy? A conference to foster discussion and networking among students, professors, and other members of the community. Speeches and discussions will revolve around the marginalization of communities as a result of democratic and non-democratic regimes around the world, i.e. Libya, United States, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That's March 12th, 1:30 to 6:30. Now, that's free, and I think they provide food and drinks there. And that's going to be held at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center here on UBC. Ethan, do you have any skeptic highlights?
I do. It's that time of year again for the Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown Pub Quiz, which is happening Saturday, March 12th at 6 p.m. at the Billy Bishop Legion. I should mention that 6 p.m. is the time the doors open. The pub quiz is going to start at 7:30, so get there at 6 and get your seats and your drink.
Wait, so this is going to be a quiz about pubs? How's that skeptical?
No, it's going to be a pub quiz, but with a skeptical theme. It's described as the CCSS is a British-style pub quiz on science and skepticism where teams of up to 4 people can compete locally and against teams from all across Canada for the right to brag they won the second annual CCSS.
Ooh.
So last year's quiz featured teams in Vancouver and Edmonton. This year they are being joined by competitors in Ottawa, Kelowna, and Victoria. So it should be a lot of fun. I encourage you to come out. We usually have some local prizes as well, so it should be a lot of fun. Again, that's Saturday, March 12th, 6 p.m., Billy Bishop Legion in Kitsilano. Well, we're out of time, so this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying, remember to download our podcast on iTunes.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
See you later, everybody.